The title of the podcast is Injustice Anywhere is a Threat to Justice Everywhere. Why listen? Well, globally, our host, Robert Brzezinczak, PhD, ABD, MS, is a former public servant, professor, author, actor, and has consulted and trained law enforcement, corrections, and intelligence agencies. Guests who are experts in their respective fields will provide candid dialogue on relevant topics. Whatever affects one affects all indirectly. Again, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. These are not his words. They are the words of the great Martin Luther King Jr. But it all represents everything we will be talking about in this podcast. As much as he will be speaking more about cybersecurity, transnational organized crime, gang-related issues, there is a link between the quote and the topic. They all talk about preserving humanity, making the world a better place.
Mm-hmm. Hello, and welcome to Injustice Anywhere is a Threat to Justice Everywhere. I'm your host, Robert Brzezinczak, and today's episode is The Underlying Nature of Mental Health and Crisis Intervention Teams. I have my guest, Dr. Bertina. Dr. Bertina is going to talk about the underlying nature of mental health and crisis intervention teams. Dr. Bertina has held several positions in the state of Florida, including forensic and children's mental health coordinator for the Florida Department of Children and Families in the 19th Judicial Circuit, systems integrator for the Southeastern Florida Behavioral Health Network, and criminal justice program director for a small university in West Palm Beach. She's a past president of the Northeastern Association of Criminal Justice Sciences and a three-time award recipient of the Academy of Criminal Justice Sciences SAGE Junior Faculty Professional Development Teaching Award. In 2020, Dr. Bertina and several students co-funded the first NAMI, National Alliance of Mental Health, chapter of Westchester University. Currently, Dr. Bertina serves as the co-advisor, and she is the advisor for Nu Beta, the WCU chapter of Alpha Phi Sigma, which is the National Criminal Justice Honor Society. Dr. Bertina endeavors to advance mental health awareness and advocacy in the criminal justice system and in the community. Welcome. How are you doing this morning?
I am well, thank you. And thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, I appreciate your time and sharing your time with myself and the listeners here.
Thank you for having me.
We're gonna dive into our segment here, and we've known each other for some time, and I just want the listeners to get to know you. Can you describe what a crisis intervention team is and how they operate?
I can. From the perspective of policing, I can do that. I know there's several, many areas where a crisis intervention team title or label is used, but in the context in which I'm used to or that I've had experience with, it's a specialized police response team. And in the context in which I've conducted my research and some practice or practitioner-based things, it is based on a model considered the Memphis model. And that is really, really focused in a 40-hour week-long training where police and other first responders get kind of a snapshot of diagnoses, different types of conditions, some psychotropic medications. They get a basic understanding throughout the course of the 5 days as to signs and symptoms of mental illness. Oftentimes they get certified in mental health first aid during the program. And then they also get different modules that have been kind of shared amongst jurisdictions using this model. Sometimes they focus on veterans issues, the aging population, community specific types of focus or areas where that crisis intervention team or the planning or steering committee has determined would best suit that community. So over the course of the week, the officers and candidates in this training are getting exposed to all different kinds of disability. They're getting a better understanding of the law in their state as it pertains to their role or their involvement in responding to people having a mental health crisis or other crisis related to disabilities in the community. And so they understand the law of their involuntary commitment statute, where they can go in and bring someone to a hospital and all of these sorts of things. There's different guests. It's really a partnership between community mental health and other behavioral health entities, as well as police departments. And they call it the crisis intervention team because it involves collaboration in the community itself. And so police get a certification, they get a PIN, they have a graduation at the end of the week. And then these are considered CIT officers who now have specialized training and hopefully one on every shift when these types of psychiatric or crisis calls come in, they will try to dispatch CIT trained officers to the scene. So that's my general understanding of crisis intervention team.
Well, I appreciate expanding on that. That's definitely helpful for those out in the community and those in the law enforcement community and the criminal justice system. Given the state of affairs with the calls for police reform, what is indicative for mental health to be at the center of conversations as it pertains to policing? So in other words, why do you think mental health should be at the center of conversations for law enforcement?
Well, I mean, my gosh, there's various reasons for that, but I think it's not, you know, the big thing obviously is community safety. We've heard of all of these incidents of citizens out there who encounter law enforcement, and when they're having a crisis event, sometimes things escalate and things don't end up so well. But I think a lot of it, we have to think about both sides. We have to consider officer safety and officer preparedness as they go into these calls, but also obviously the citizens, the consumers, the people who are calling 911, the family members, that kind of understanding of what to anticipate and how to communicate for both sides. So in terms of why mental illness has become, I hate to use this terminology, but a hot topic right now is because of the visibility of these types of calls and the high incidence of someone getting injured at the scene. And oftentimes it's the citizen. And we hear about police shooting of citizens with mental health conditions or other disabilities or developmental disabilities and people, you know, including people with autism. There's been a lot in the media. But Bob, it's not without saying when we talk about mental illness and mental health, why it's so important in policing is because it's definitely important from the citizen's perspective in feeling safe making that call, but also for the officers themselves, because we need to also consider officer wellness based on police stress and trauma and what they're exposed to as well. So because of these incidents, we need to look at things from both perspectives and really focus our efforts on safety for all parties involved and how we can make that happen. How can we be more effective as a country in general when it comes to training our officers, providing them resources, reducing stigma so that they will get the assistance that they need when they need it? So it's just a big conversation, and it's one that seems to be in many circles right now.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought that up for both sides of the aisle, because having been a DC police officer myself, I worked with a number of folks that, you know, there was some bravado involved in the job, and, you know, we were type A, some of us, and we never sought out counseling or help because we were looked at in some folks' opinion, weak because we did that. And
right,
you know, it is kind of a stigma for someone in the law enforcement ranks to go get help, because half the time you go do that, then you're sitting on the desk, you're not on the street, because the police agency doesn't trust you on the street, which is, you know, rightfully so in some instances that you should get help and you shouldn't be on the street. But a lot of the folks knew that I worked with and didn't seek out counseling because they felt that they were going to be benched for just doing something to help themselves. I mean, how do you come at that?
I agree. And that's the point. And it's interesting because I teach this class, which maybe you'll ask about or maybe not, but it's forensic mental health. And of course, I'm in a criminal justice department teaching it. So many of my students are aspiring to be some form of law enforcement, local, state, federal. And they will ask me those questions. You know, at the end of the day, they say, Dr. Bertina, this all sounds great. And yes, we agree. But for the same reasons you just said, Bob, how do we go, you know, how do you convince someone who's in policing, that's their career, to seek out psychiatric care when it could potentially have ramifications negative based on their job duties and things and the stigma that goes along with it. So the whole point, what we need to be doing as a community is reducing or minimizing the stigma, raising awareness, increasing empathy. And a lot of the trainings that law enforcement now is being are being exposed to or is being exposed to, I guess, as a field or a discipline or criminal justice in general. So you've got corrections staff, the same thing. These criminal justice workers are now attending more of these trainings, I think as an attempt to educate, but also to reduce the stigma associated with mental illness and mental health needs.
Well, that's much needed and good to hear. So, you know, as society becomes more knowledgeable about mental health and its implications of not being properly evaluated, what are the methods of trainings and policies that crisis intervention teams utilize to lessen the burden on law enforcement officers and protect the lives of people with mental illness?
So there's a few things. So the crisis intervention team itself, as I said, that 40-hour week-long curriculum involving multiple pieces, I'm sorry that I can't speak to this, but I can only speak to the crisis intervention teams with whom I guess I've been associated with, and that is in Florida, also in Pennsylvania, and a couple of key spots throughout the state, that they are incorporating crisis intervention team training is incorporating that mental health first aid piece, which in and of itself is really an 8-hour training. Most times it could be 8 to 12 hours. And that gives candidates or trainees an additional certification. I think it's up to 3 years where they get exposed to signs and symptoms, seeking help. It's kind of first aid or CPR training, but related to mental health and how to keep someone safe before a professional can come along, making recommendations for professional services. So I know that one of the officers in particular in Pennsylvania, who I'm familiar with, who does the mental health first aid piece for the CIT throughout the week, he's talked plenty about how he introduces the idea of officer wellness in that training. Aside from the mental health first aid certificate, during the candidates that go through CIT, also there is a module that's dedicated to police wellness, officer wellness, and seeking help, the things that we're talking about here. So they get a whole module on that where fellow officers come in, they present. So a lot of the CIT training involves officers presenting to the trainees. So recognizing that a lot of times police or others who are attending these trainings are more receptive to the message when it's coming from someone who they feel like they can relate to, who understands the stress, who understands what they're doing. So officers will come in and talk to them about wellness. So in that way, they attempt to, again, reduce the stigma. I think you're asking me specific to the crisis intervention team. And I think just that, itself during the 40 hours, but then Bob, understand that even after officers get certified in CIT as CIT officers, they in many jurisdictions are offered follow-up trainings, kind of like updated continuing education type, where they can come back for a day or for a few hours and get additional training. And I know a lot of that has talked about de-escalation and again, seeking help, seeking therapy when needed, and dealing with the stress, the accumulated stress, the vicarious trauma, and these types of things. So there's various ways that it depends on the community and their resources and how they address those things.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head. You know, if you have another law enforcement officer who's been there, done that, talking to other law enforcement officers, one tends to think that they would listen. You know, there are folks in the crowd that won't, you can't reach everyone, but, you know, in essence, that's a great concept to have someone who's done the job to talk to people who are doing the job. So, law enforcement evolved over the years as it relates to the incorporation of mental health awareness. and the establishment of crisis intervention teams. Do you think we're where we need to be, or this is kind of a loaded question, or do we need to do more?
Wow, I definitely think we need to do more. I can say this, and I say this to my students, and I've said it in front of practitioners when they've come to talk to my student. I had a panel a couple of years ago before COVID in the live classroom that consisted of someone from the jail, mental health deputy from the jail, someone from policing. Actually, it's the officer I was referring to who does the officer wellness piece. I had someone who does forensic coordination at the courts. And I just had a panel of different people who work at different stages with the population of folks in the community who have mental health needs, who may be justice involved. I had them give all their perspectives. And we say, consistently, the job isn't done. But what we do agree with is that criminal justice, in particular the police, they have, like you said, they have made such progress in the implementation of these SPRs, these specialized police response teams or programs, trainings. They have went miles above. A lot of times in many communities, the police have access to more resources, more money, more training than the mental health staff or the providers of services. And that creates sort of an argument sometimes because police feel like they're being burdened with really running the mental health program in their area or dealing with mental illness more than the providers do, but they sometimes have more resources to do so, unfortunately. So in that way, we need to beef up resources in the communities to allow for both sides to get access, to get programs, to get funded for, diversion strategies in addition to these police training. So police have come so far, very far. They've been given access to tools they did not have previously. But in some departments, Bob, like especially rural areas where they're so small, they can't send officers to these trainings. We need to do more there for sure. We need to offer alternatives to maybe the 40-hour week to give them some sort of training. These pockets, and we still very much need to change the overall culture, because even we offer these trainings that underlying that department level executive, or I guess, and through the higher ranking officials in policing, that police culture that drives the whole department, that's really where we need to be focusing awareness and buy-in for these programs. And I think we have much to do in that particular area.
Yeah, it definitely is an inside out approach that needs to be taken, because if you have a culture where it's frowned upon for you to go get and help for yourself, then that needs to change. And I can tell you, in my travels and in my career, that has been basically the lay of the land. You are weak if you move forward with seeking out counseling. And I don't want to disparage any of the agencies I work for, but it was the culture. It was just the culture of guys that we work and girls that I worked with.
Yep.
And we just need to change that. And as you said, we need to also put some funding towards that. I worked in a major metropolitan area. That's a bit different than going to Westchester or a smaller town, that you have to have the funding to do stuff, to speak to your point. And so, as we reach election season here, think about that when you're all going out to vote. The person you put in office is an advocate or should be an advocate for you and I. And so it starts with them in terms of getting the budget and implementing those proper policies within the community. So,
I agree.
I think, the next thing that I'm going to talk about is, current screening mechanisms that law enforcement agencies employ to properly hire law enforcement officers to ensure that they are mentally equipped in responding to crises. In your travels, I'll speak mostly to this because I've been a cop, but in your travels, what's your take on this? In the folks that you've talked to that are law enforcement officers, do you think there's current proper screening mechanisms for equipped for law enforcement officers?
I that's such a difficult question because, as you know, I don't have a direct practitioner background in policing in itself. But from what I do know, and in conversations, as you've said, the one theme that I've heard over and over again throughout research projects and things is, number one, the identification of a champion in the department who will, you know, raise awareness, build the buy-in from the top down, and having that person who is, you know, all about this change of culture. So having someone like that who does the groundwork and builds the department, but also when you say about screening and understanding officer capability to, you know, I think the theme there that I've heard consistently is we do a decent job at the start, at the new hire start, at the beginning of the process, but there's not enough follow-up. In other words, consistent, almost like a check-in, periodic check-ins as to the psychological health of our individual officers. Only when there's an incident do sometimes these things get questioned, but maybe if we do a periodic screen or just an updated screen, because again, and I don't know enough about police departments individually to know what they're doing, but I would like to say that oftentimes these incidents, as we read about them in the newspaper or, you know, in the online, the way they unfold in the media and we learn about it, it seemed like in many cases there were signs there that the officer was dealing with a lot of underlying stress or tension, or maybe overexposure to traumatic events. And maybe if we would have screened that person more consistently, or the department as a whole, we would have been able to offer or require some kind of psychological therapy or counseling for all officers so that they're not targeted. If one or two go, maybe if it was required for all, periodic assessment and therapy, that might be something. But these are the things I've heard in conversation.
Right, and doing this firsthand, I can tell you, you know, we've had psychological tests, we've had polygraphs, we've had background checks in the hiring process. And, you know, you and I both know in the criminal justice system, anybody can game the system, whether you work in it or you're not in it. And so,
did I say I knew that? I don't know if I want to say that, but yeah, no, I've heard that before. I'll say that.
Well, you know, that's a very political answer. So I'm going to step out there and say that I know that in the criminal justice system, people can game the system, whether you work in it or outside of it. So thanks for that caveat. essentially, you know, what I've seen and heard will astound folks out there. And I've hoped that since things have been rectified, but, you know, people back in the day when they were taking a polygraph, they would take relaxers, go into the polygraph so their mind's off of what's going on. Some people literally put tacks in the bottom of their shoes so they would step on it and focus on the pain. These are things that have actually occurred.
Wow. So, I have not heard that one. Interesting.
So, you know, I know of these things. I haven't done them. I'm just telling you that, let me caveat that. But I can tell you people in the industry, they have gamed the system. And so when it comes to the psych, you know, we've all taken, and I'm sure you've done this, the Myers-Briggs test. So you can game that also. And I can tell you that the multitude of questions, you over and over, you can absolutely game the system in answering the right questions in the way that you think someone wants you to answer it. And then also with the background, I've heard folks that have, you know, people in their circles that they've literally paid monies to say the right thing, or had leverage on those folks. So again, not me, but folks that I've heard of.
I've heard that part too. And I've had several calls to get recommendations from former students. And I feel like it's a good approach. I certainly have said some things that where I did have reservations. I've expressed it when I needed to, but I don't know. I guess I could see that the possibility of folks aligning the right people to call, but I don't know how far the police departments dig I'm not really schooled in that like you are, so I'm not sure.
They dig pretty far, but if you, and they know that, they start from the top of who you recommend, but then they also go out in a neighborhood for somebody they don't think that will, you know, knows you like that. So,
okay.
So they kind of weed those things out. But if you have a consensus in a neighborhood of folks that are, hey, he's a good guy, blah, 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 and say, kind of saying the same thing, you got to wonder. Because I've actually done background checks on folks when I was in South Carolina. So I'm educated in all these different nuances of people gaming the system because I've actually done the background checks on folks. But, you know, when law enforcement is faced with a crisis, you know, what's the processes of intervention that they should adhere to in order to stay within the proper bounds of the encounter with individuals suffering from mental illness?
Oh gosh, that's so department by department yet again. But when we're talking about CIT, the main piece of the training that has become so favored and important is the de-escalation piece, in that ability to, how do I word it? Get to a person's level without judgment, or reach an individual who is having a mental health crisis in some way, where you're not exactly playing into anything. In other words, if the person is clearly delusional or saying, you know, things, you know, expressing that they're a person who you know they're not, or that they're seeing things that aren't there, if they're hallucinating, to not so much play into that, but be able to approach the person in a way to get them to trust you, to feel that you're there to help them. Minimal stress, as minimal stress as possible. And I recognize, and we talk about this all the time in my classes, because we watch videos and we talk about incidents that have happened. In many cases, this is impossible for officers, right? So there's that whole use of force continuum, and they're used to that, and that's the kind of role. But CIT tries to get to the point of, let's talk about de-escalation, let's give you tools. Police will often say, you know, you give us a hammer and you want us to go to these calls where we needed like a saw, a screwdriver, or this, but you only gave us a hammer. So what do you expect the outcome is going to be? And so the CIT is giving the officers these additional tools, such as de-escalation, such as there's a piece in one of the modules where they have folks, and NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness in the community, will usually send folks in for this part. They'll be the ones who are running the show, where there's a piece, the consumer panel. So they'll have a couple of citizens come in, or family members, and actually speak to the officers who are being trained about their encounters with police and what they wish would have happened instead. And there's this whole back and forth conversation with the officers as well as the community members. And it's an incredible, enlightening event. So I think a big piece, Bob, is de-escalation, and that's for everyone's safety, okay? When it's possible. Sometimes, unfortunately, you get to a call and the person who, you know, the citizen who's in crisis will come at you immediately with a deadly weapon, whether it's a knife, a gun, or a screwdriver. And sometimes the officers, there's not time for them to de-escalate the situation or attempt something different, less than lethal. And unfortunately, people die or get injured. And sometimes the officers die. So as much as you can, de-escalation, talking a person down, offering resources, there's all different ways to address these calls, bringing them to the hospital as a diversion strategy for evaluation under whatever the state's commitment statute is. There's usually a piece of the law in the state that will allow for officers to do what they call emergency commitments. So in that situation, the officer would have to file a petition. It goes usually very quickly. There's a delegate who's on call 24/7. They have to verbally approve it. based on the evidence that there has to meet certain criteria. It's usually that a person presents as a danger to themselves or others, that the officer had witnessed this or observed this, they have a mental illness, and you know, there's a threat there, there's a danger for the person or for others. So the officer then meets the criteria, depending on what that is in that law, and they can transport a person to the local kind of receiving facility, the designated receiving, whether it's an ER or a standalone crisis intervention unit, and that person will get evaluated to see if they need to be, you know, take it further and committed further. There's usually up to a certain amount of time the hospital can keep them there for evaluation. And again, that depends on the state. So that's an option that officers use quite frequently when they're dealing with someone who's having a mental health crisis. So they use that option a lot. So it just depends on the circumstances on this at the call.
Yeah, and I can't help but wonder, you know, we talked about this. I showed you a video and I said I would speak to it. You know, yes. if the officers and some of the folks who responded, I actually played high school football with in Plains Township, PA. If Jeffrey Spade could have got that that help in advance of shooting his neighbors, basically he killed a couple and killed himself over a snow removal dispute. And James right. Goy and Lisa Goy were the victims of his rage. He came across, as you saw the video, with automatic weapons and shot at both the wife and the husband, went back into his house, came back, killed them, went back into his house, and then killed himself. And I can't help but wonder, you know, if the officers and the community in advance of this could have helped Jeffrey Spade get that help, that mental help, before the officers had to go out there and respond to this horrific event in my hometown. And it's about the yeah. police and the community working together to recognize those triggers, those issues within the community before an event like this occurs. Now, we all know that some of us don't talk to our neighbors and vice versa, but you kind of know what's going on in your neighborhood. And you can report those types of things. And so what I would advocate, having been on the flip side and as a police officer, is to look to the community and say, hey, there's somebody in the community you may want to look at. We may want to get some resources and help and mental health for those folks. That was one of the things when you're talking that came to my mind.
And it comes to my mind too. And honestly, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I just, it's so difficult because I don't have enough background and maybe I didn't ask the right questions when I saw that video, but if there, and I presume based on what you're saying that there must have been prior maybe calls to the police for that particular resident, the man, the perpetrator there and that, or the person who was enraged, or there's some knowledge that he had mental health needs. Now, Bob, there's a couple of different things that I talk about, you know, in the field and with my students. There's things like assisted outpatient treatment, which is AOT, and that is oftentimes part of state legislation as well, that you have, you know, these involuntary commitments that I talked about to bring someone in an emergency situation to a hospital. Well, there's also court-ordered treatment for a person in the community. In other words, they don't have to go inpatient, but in many jurisdictions throughout the country, there's a legislation or there's a law that provides a person in the community setting for kind of court ordered, forcing them, if you will, and involuntarily to go get treatment. And a lot of states, a lot of communities, they have the laws and they don't use them. Obviously for the controversial, but the liberty, you know, you're saying to someone, well, you have the right to refuse mental health treatment if you've not committed a crime, if you're not incarcerated, if you're not a danger to yourself or others, you have the right to refuse, but wait a minute, we're gonna take away that right, but you have to meet certain criteria. Again, usually the person is a threat to the dangerousness standard, we call it, danger to self or others. That person, you know, meets other criteria, like they have frequent hospitalizations or they've been we say in Pennsylvania 302'd multiple times, which is that involuntary emergency commitment to the hospital. They have a history of frequent incarcerations and they have mental illness. So sometimes they meet the criteria, and in some cases you can get court ordered treatment where it's not inpatient, right? So there's that. Maybe that person came to the attention of law enforcement or he had been hospitalized previously, and that might have been an avenue if he met the criteria. There is also, in addition to CIT, other specialized responses not involving police. And now we're going in that direction, like CAHOOTS teams out of the Pacific Northwest really is where they've been piloted. But I know Philadelphia and other places in Pennsylvania have been talking about starting a CAHOOTS team, which is not police. It's actually first responders, like EMT type crisis, people who are trained in crisis response, who will go out at a citizen call to check on a person, like a wellness visit to see if they're okay. Are they off their medication? This way we try to divert them from the criminal justice system. So had there been something like that, a mobile crisis team that a neighbor could have called if that person we're talking about was showing signs that they were being triggered or that something was happening. So there's different ways. It depends on the community and their access to resources. And I don't know what was available in that particular area. I don't know if he had been hospitalized previously. Maybe you know. I don't know. But if police were being consistently called to that residence, there are options for them. If they were CIT officers, there might have been a mobile crisis. I just don't know what was available in that particular area.
And that's the key thing. We just don't know what's in someone's head. And it's how do we manage that as a community, as the criminal justice system, and to better protect ourselves and society. So I really want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
It's been very enlightening. And so if the audience wants to get in contact with you, how do they do that?
Well, I teach at Westchester University in the Criminal Justice Department. So they can send me an email. They can go to Westchester's Criminal Justice page and find me there. And it's M Bratina, B-R-A-T-I-N-A at WCUPA.edu. They can reach me that way, probably the best way.
All right. Well, I can't thank you enough, Dr. Bratina, Michelle.
Thank you for having me, Bob. It was nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk with you. Thank you for everyone listening. And again, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Thank you and take care.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on Instagram at Brzezinczek Foundation Corp and on Twitter at BrzezinczekFound1. To see our efforts on social justice and criminal justice reform, check out our website at www.robertbrzezinczek.com. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.